there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your head. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there.
Welcome to On the Wing podcast presented by Purina Pro Plan. It is spring, even in the far reaches of the winter wonderland that is often the Great Lakes states. It is spring finally. And although it is spring, the hunting options in the springtime are pretty limited across most of the country, with the exception of the wild gobbler becoming the king of spring. And what stands out to me as I think about turkey hunting in the springtime is the cacophony of sound of a morning in Mother Nature waking up. And I'm thinking, obviously, of the putting and the yelping and the gobbling of wild turkeys. But of equal prominence in my mind are the calls of cranes and swans and ducks and geese and the croaking of frogs and the crowing of roosters and the drumming of rough grouse. And in the southern states, I think of the whistling of bobwhite quail. And it's at that intersection between the whistling of bobwhites and the gobbling of turkeys where I want to put the focus on today's podcast conversation. So today I've got two biologists who have spent their lives studying the intersection between quail and turkeys. They've studied the habitat, the food sources, the biology, as well as some of the mythology involving both birds. I'm excited to welcome to the podcast for her first time, Sarah Watkins, a PhD candidate studying wild turkeys with Tennessee Tech University. And Quail Forever's very own, making his return to the podcast, our state coordinator for Louisiana, Jackson Shaken, Not Stirred, Martini, for a conversation focused on this intersection between bobwhite quail and wild turkeys. And yes, riding shotgun for a conversation about turkeys and quail, who better than Quail Forever Journal editor Ryan Sparks? Ryan, I bet you got a flock of turkeys outside your window at this very moment, don't you?
I'm ready. I'm ready. We open up here next week for the shotgun season, so I'm ready to go.
As we're recording at the beginning of April, this will come out a few weeks from now. You are in southeastern Nebraska, where turkeys are almost religious, aren't they?
For me, yeah. For me. Me and Jackson and I were kind of talking before we pressed record here, and we were just talking about how one of the beautiful things about this area and turkeys is that, and maybe I shouldn't put this out there on the podcast, but you can get permission, like, very easily. It's actually a rarity for somebody to turn you down when you knock on their door and ask to hunt turkeys. The older generations just didn't grow up with them here, and there's not that value like there is with whitetails or bobwhites. So that's part of the reason I love them. I get to explore the places that I grew up, and I kind of get the keys to the castle to romp around southeast Nebraska and see some different country.
Is it an over-the-counter tag or multiple tags in Nebraska these days?
For residents, it's just over the counter, and then non-residents, they limit the amount of permits. They're over the counter, but there's 10,000. It's capped at 10,000, and they sell out within an hour. So if you don't have one in your pocket right now, sorry, but you're gonna have to wait till next year to hunt Nebraska turkeys.
And how many turkeys can a Nebraskan shoot in a year? Is it down to one this year?
It's two.
Two. Okay.
It was a few years ago, it was three. And back when it was three, you could also shoot all three of those in one day if you wanted to, or if you had the ability to. And now they've changed it to two turkeys and one turkey per day. I actually really enjoy the one turkey per day because it spreads out your season rather than just calling in a group of birds and pulling the trigger a couple times. You get to have like multiple experiences with wild turkeys throughout the spring. So it's a lot of fun.
What age did you start hunting turkeys?
Oh, I was probably 12 or 13. I kind of, when I was starting to get into hunting, was also the time when wild turkeys were starting to really take off in southeast Nebraska. So I kind of hit that intersection perfectly, and I've had the turkey bug pretty bad ever since then. So
what year roughly was that?
That would have been about around 2000.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hunted turkeys when I was probably 15 years old. So it would have been the late 80s in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And I shot a turkey. My uncle called in a turkey for me, shot a turkey about 20 minutes in the first time I ever hunted him. And it's like, this is easy. I went two decades until my next one.
Yeah. I was going to say, I did not have that experience. The other thing is because nobody grew up with turkeys around here. Nobody knew how to hunt them. So it was also like, this was, you know, back like early internet days. Like there wasn't get on YouTube and look up a video on how to call turkeys. And it was just Ryan fumbling around in the woods figuring out how to try to get close enough to a turkey. So,
well, let me bring in Sarah and Jackson to the conversation. We'll start with Sarah. Thank you for joining us this morning. I mentioned you're a PhD candidate. Give us a little bit about the Sarah Watkins story, where you're from, how you got interested in turkeys, and tell us a little bit more about what you're studying.
Yeah, I might get booed out if I tell you where I'm from. I'm originally from Florida. I grew up in true Osceola country. Had no idea how cool that was until I got to college and how cool that opportunity was. So I went to college at the University of Florida for my bachelor's degree studying wildlife ecology and conservation science. Left having no idea what I wanted to do specifically. I did go on a turkey hunt for my first time in college while I was at Florida. And I think that's probably where I got the turkey bug. I just didn't know it yet. I spent the next 2 years all over North America and Central America studying different species, including wild turkeys. I studied turkeys in Florida, Missouri, and then eventually Tennessee. And it was while I was on the Tennessee Wild Turkey Project that I got poached. I got poached to the Wild Turkey Lab at the University of Georgia, where I went and did my master's degree in genetics of wild turkey, of all things. Never, ever would have thought of myself as a geneticist, but it was the question of the time, and I enjoyed it. And it allowed me to work with not only the population in Georgia, but Louisiana and South Carolina as well. And then from there, I rolled straight into a PhD at Tennessee Tech University here in Cookeville, Tennessee. But I actually work with wild turkeys in Kentucky. So I am on year 4 of the wild turkey reproductive ecology study. So we're doing mostly female-based stuff, looking at population ecology, reproduction, but also doing some broader landscape questions as well.
Wow. You mentioned your first turkey hunt in Florida. Was that it for Osceolas?
It was an eastern hunt. We were just outside of Gainesville, Florida, so that would be in our eastern range.
Okay. And you mentioned going to University of Georgia. Did you study with Dr. James Martin?
He was there. He was actually on my thesis committee. He was not my main advisor, but yes, he was on my committee.
And what about quail? Any connection to quail through your growing up in Florida and studying in Georgia and living in Tennessee?
Several places, yeah. So in Florida, actually, I worked on a large ranch in South Florida, and they had quail populations down there that they managed pretty intensively for, both wild populations and also pen-reared quail for some hunts. Yeah. So that was really my first exposure to doing any sort of management for quail. And of course, managing for both quail and turkey down there. There's quite a bit of overlap down there in Florida. In Georgia, part of our research site there went on to Piedmont National Wildlife Refuge, where they have pretty intensively managed for red-cockaded woodpecker, which a lot of their management benefits and lends towards quail habitat. So we did have a pretty healthy population of quail in Georgia as well.
Cool. It sounds like you a perfect guest for us to have the intersection between the two over a variety of states. Yeah, go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, you were talking about genetics, so I immediately jumped to the turkey genetics. I'm not sure like how familiar everyone listening is with sort of the conservation story of wild turkeys and how they made such a huge comeback. But there was a lot of reintroductions to different states, one of them being Nebraska. And the thing that we always run into here, and I know a lot of other states too, because people are looking for their turkey slam to get one of the each of the, you know, like your Rio, your Merriam's, your Eastern, and the Osceola in Florida. How much like genetic purity is there in those areas where turkeys were reintroduced? Because everyone always just says, oh, they're all hybrids now. Like, but technically, like, we should have this area, we should have Easterns, we should have Rios, we should have Merriam's all in Nebraska. But I don't know how much overlap there is in their ranges and genetically what that looks like.
There are, there's actually currently a large study going on that is trying to tease that out. When I was doing my project, we were kind of taking the first stab at it, and we were very regionally focused, again, just doing populations in Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina. Now they're expanding that to a nationwide study, and they're finding relics. There are traces of source populations. So if we sample a bird in Nebraska, they're finding some of that historic restocking. They can tell where the bird came from, essentially.
That's cool.
So yes, they are kind of just a mixed hybrid thing. I think it's, I mean, for me, it's way less about, oh, I'm shooting, you know, I want to get my Eastern and my Osceola or my Eastern and my Rio. And for me, it's about the habitat. I want to go chase turkeys and all the different habitats and all the different vegetation communities that they occupy. That's the cool part to me.
Cool. Yeah. That's another very cool thing about quail, I think, as well, is you can find them, like you said, in South Florida, you know, in like a jungle-like swamp environment, or you can go to, you know, Nebraska here and hunt them in the Midwest and so many different areas across the country.
Let's jump to Mr. Martini. Jackson, Jack, the man of many names. You've been on the podcast before, but it's been a minute. Give us a little bit about your background so our listeners connect with you.
Sure. Well, first, I just want to say last time that we did the podcast, and you did the shaken, not stirred joke. About a week later, I got a package in my mail that said Jackson Martini, shaken, not stirred. So thanks for that. so yeah, I'm from North Central Pennsylvania. Went to Penn State, got my degrees in wildlife fishery sciences. Kind of like Sarah, bounced around the continental U.S. for a few years. Didn't make it outside of the country like she did, but you know, I was working on various research projects, songbirds, elk, mourning doves, but the majority of that time was spent on a wild turkey research project. I'm kind of a turkey junkie myself, like Ryan. And then in 2019, I got on with the organization. I was a farm bill biologist with Pheasants Forever for a little over 4 years. And in June 2023, had the opportunity to come down to Louisiana as state coordinator. Started putting positions on the ground in Louisiana in January 2024. Since that time, we've had 7 positions created and hit the ground. We've got another position coming this summer, hopefully, in a new part of the state. Jason Kendall's been working his tail off down here, growing our chapter base. We started with 4 chapters when I got here. We're currently at 9, so he's really been killing it the past, I think he's been with us 2 years now. So yeah, we're just kind of growing our conservation footprint, bringing new partners into the fold, new initiatives, projects, new positions and coverage areas, you know. One of my biologists, Kelly, one of our biologists, I should say, Kelly, has taken the role of, I guess, amplifying our presence on social media. So she's really been doing good work there, you know, as far as online outreach and getting new landowners and volunteers involved with us. So it's been pretty well so far.
Cool. Congratulations. There's been a tremendous growth for the organization in Louisiana, which is wonderful because there is a lot of habitat opportunity, public land. There is a lot of opportunity in the state of Louisiana.
Yeah, for sure. It's been a lot, but it's been a lot of fun. I'm really glad to be here. You know, like I said, building new partnerships and, you know, finding new projects on WMAs down here. There are quail in Louisiana, I promise. A lot of people say there's not. They're here. And we've got a few projects in different parts of the state on WMAs to improve the quality that is there or build off of current, you know, core habitats that are holding quail to try and expand that. So,
For folks that are listening that are acquainted with both of you, they're probably wondering, well, when are they going to talk about how they met? Because as I understand it, Jackson and Sarah, you guys have been dating 6 to 7 years.
7 and a half.
So was there a 7 and a half years? Is there a, did you meet at school studying turkeys and quail? Was there a connection relevant to this podcast?
I'm going to let Sarah answer that. So.
Oh, man. even better, not at school. We met on a wild turkey research project in Missouri, actually.
Nice.
Really?
Yeah. We have Jason Isabel to thank. He was the turkey biologist at the time, hired me on, and Jackson was our crew lead and ran the show.
Doesn't paint me in the best light.
That's just where we met.
Yeah. So Sarah was a temp. She was there during the trapping season, and then she left to go to South Dakota.
Yep.
And later on in life, we ended up reconnecting, and now we're talking to you, Bob.
in a long distance relationship, Tennessee to Louisiana.
Yeah. Yeah. We've not lived in the same state.
Wow. So. Wow. All right. Well, I could tell I'm making you uncomfortable. So I won't ask any more relationship questions. We'll move it forward to turkeys and quail. Before we do that, I want to thank Purina Pro Plan for being the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast and the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. My pups have always eaten Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the mission of our organization, which is important to me, but what's most important to me is that Purina Pro Plan has a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. Pro Plan was built for the bird dog like yours and like mine. You can learn more at ProPlansport.com.
From Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever National Headquarters in St. Paul, Minnesota, this is Casey Sill with the inaugural edition of the Upland Newsroom, delivering top stories from the Habitat Organization and across America's pheasant, quail, and prairie grouse ranges. We begin today in Kansas, where Governor Laura Kelly recently signed a bill creating a specialty license plate featuring the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever logos. The new plates will be available starting July 1st, with all funds going to habitat conservation in the state. Over 600 Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever supporters advocated for the new plates, helping push the effort over the finish line with state lawmakers. The farm bill has been top of mind for upland hunters and dog trainers in recent weeks, as vague language concerning a ban on greyhound racing has left some wondering if it could also open the door to a ban on using live game lures for all dog training activities, including for pointing and retrieving dogs. Hunting and training advocates are urging lawmakers to clarify the language before the bill proceeds, and the Habitat organization is working with elected officials on both sides of the aisle to ensure that happens. Speaking with FarmProgress.com, Pheasants Forever Director of Communications Jared Wicklund said the organization is actively working with Congress and partners to ensure the vague language does not become law, and says he's confident there's time to make that change. The Farm Bill news comes just as training season kicks off across the uplands, as we all head back into the field after a long off-season. The start of training season also means nesting season is right around the corner, so remember to pay attention to off-leash laws in your area and keep your dogs out of nesting habitat this spring and summer. Here in the north, those laws went into effect on April 16th, and it will remain illegal to run dogs on public land in Minnesota through July 14th. The organization also has a trio of new chapters to celebrate as spring gets underway. In my home state of Nebraska, the Wild West Women on the Wing chapter is the very first women's chapter in the Cornhusker state. They'll host their first event this fall in Gehring, Nebraska, and will focus on fundraising and women's outreach in the western half of the state. Moving as far south as south can go, Louisiana has a new Quail Forever chapter. The Heart of Kissatchee chapter will be focused on building and improving habitat in the Kissatchee National Forest, a key quail focal area in Louisiana. Finally, we'll highlight South Dakota, where yet another chapter has sprung up in the pheasant capital of the world. The Turner Hutch chapter will be improving habitat in the southeast corner of the state and will add quality public lands in both Turner and Hutchinson counties. If you're interested in joining or learning more about these chapters, visit pheasantsforever.org and utilize our Find a Chapter tool. Hands-on Habitat Month begins May 1st, where volunteers nationwide take part in local habitat projects and community engagement. This is our annual call to action, a chance to roll up our sleeves, get our hands dirty, and demonstrate what conservation really looks like. To learn more and get involved with Hands-on Habitat Month, visit pheasantsforever.org/hands-on-habitat. That'll do it for the very first edition of the Upland Newsroom. Reporting from PF and QF headquarters in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Casey Sill.
All right, Jackson, you've worked with landowners in virtually every role, well, I guess every role you've had with our organization. As I understand it, when you're talking to landowners across the southern United States, whether that's in Louisiana where you are today or in Tennessee where Sarah is, that landowners are generally focused on improving their property for both turkeys and for quail. From a priority perspective, is that true? Are those the two species that generally rise to the top?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of folks reach out to us because we've got Quail Forever on our hats and our chests, so we're kind of the quail specialists, but I would say the majority of our landowners are also interested in turkey habitat or our turkey hunters themselves. So it's definitely something we keep in mind when we're writing our management plans. And at the end of the day, quality quail habitat is quality turkey habitat.
So Sarah, when I think about quail, I think about shrub obligates, because that's been beaten into my head by all our quail biologists, grassland birds that love being next to shrub. But when I think about turkeys, I think about woodland creatures. You know, I know that they, you know, spend some time picking corn, eating on the edge of ag fields, but I think about them being forest species. I'm not a biologist. Help me understand where there's overlap between those two birds, and do they need the same habitat or do they need two different types of habitat?
Yes, so turkeys are a very seasonal critter, whereas with your quail, you're going to find them in your shrub and grasslands year-round. For turkeys, that's not necessarily true. Turkeys, especially female wild turkeys, they tend to have the most overlap with what you would consider quail habitat in the spring and summer seasons when they're nesting and brood rearing. So while, yes, of course, turkeys are always going to be tied to our woodlots, you know, they're a tree roosting species, the most overlap we're going to see is during that reproductive period in the spring and summer for females.
So a hen turkey, are they looking for the exact same type of nesting cover as a bobwhite quail hen?
Not necessarily. Actually, with wild turkeys, we kind of have our average female wild turkey, right, where she likes this hip to chest high, quite dense cover, stuff you would also probably find a quail in out in the grasslands or shrubs. Turkeys tend to have a lot of variability in nest site selection. I think where some of the very intentional selection comes, where you have intentional selection for areas that you would also find quail in, is actually during that brood rearing period. Not necessarily nesting. There's just a lot of variability during nesting season.
When you look at quail chicks and turkey poults, are their like needs nutritionally pretty similar the first few weeks?
As far as needing high sources of protein, so going for like, bugging, yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was thinking of, is just those forbs with insects and having that available for chicks.
Yep.
Yeah.
So what you're getting at is the brood cover for turkeys and quail are very similar. They need high forb density for insect production. Is that accurate?
Yeah, yeah. So you're looking for that 50-50 blend between kind of your forbs and grasses with a lot of bare ground interspersed in between. You're looking for 3D structure in the vegetation that's going to support that microhabitat, those good temperature and moisture kind of settings for production of your bugs, of your arthropods.
So that to me seems pretty clear, that they spend similar time after the hatch looking for bugs in places that they can move around in. What I'm still a little bit unclear is the distinction between what each bird is looking for from a nesting perspective. Can you describe that, Sarah? Like what kind of is ideal nesting habitat for, let's start with turkeys first.
Here's where I'm going to probably have not a hot take, but it's just a true one. So like I said, we have an average hen, right? You have most of our hens are selecting for nesting habitat that is usually on an edge. So whether that's forest field edge, et cetera, whatever your forest community is, whether you're in a pine stand or your hardwood species, they like those edge habitat where forests meet kind of your fields. That's typically going to be characterized by hip to chest high cover, meaning that when that hen is laying on the ground incubating her nest, you probably can't see her. However, you have hens that, of course, break from the normal. You have hens that will nest in very open habitats, like at the base of an oak tree, and you can see her from 100 yards away. And then I will have hens that nest so deep, you know, in a honeysuckle thicket underneath a power line that, you know, is thicker than what we would see of our average hen. That's selection. So yes, for nest site selection, there is the average hen. That's not necessarily tied to nest success.
And then describe, maybe Jackson, you want to answer, describe what bobwhite quail are looking for in ideal nesting cover.
So Dr. Martin has this concept or graphic, I guess, that's that he calls the quail quadrilateral. And you're looking for in quality quail habitat, you're looking for about 25% of the cover being native grasses, 25% being native wildflowers and legumes, 25% being some woody structure, and 25% being bare ground. Typically you're gonna find those quail using nesting at the base of like a clump of little blue stem, kind of tuck up in there and build their nest bowl around that cover. So I would say from a nesting standpoint, those warm season grass clumps are going to be very important for quail. But that bare ground kind of is Sarah was talking about earlier, that bare ground is really important for when those eggs hatch. Those quail chicks need to be mobile and it needs to be open so they can get around. They don't have waterproof feathers, right? So a quail, if those birds were in a non-native grass, like turf grass pasture, and they're walking around in the morning where there's dew and everything, they're going to get soaking wet. When they're just a couple of days old, they don't have the waterproof feathers, right? So they're not going to make it very long before they go hypothermic and probably die.
When it comes to the biology of reproduction for both of the birds, you know, so if a quail loses its nest to predation, say a raccoon gets the eggs, we know that quail will drop another nest of eggs. If the quail loses its clutch to predation, largely they're done because the bird has switched from nesting mode to mom mode. What about with turkeys? Do they follow a very similar pattern when it comes to re-nesting attempts?
Yeah.
Sarah, you go ahead and answer that one.
Yeah, they tend to follow the same pattern, right? Where if they lose a nest, they're more likely to re-nest if conditions are good. Now, this is tied to phenology, right? This is tied to the calendar. So those early nest attempts, if a hen has a nest early in the season and it fails relatively early in that first month or so, she's more likely to re-nest than someone who, let's say, doesn't start nesting until mid-May, if we're talking southeast. She's less likely to try again just because we have moved later into the season. I have had birds who have successfully hatched a nest, had their clutch, lost their brood, and then re-nested.
Oh, wow.
That's rare. I have about one turkey do that every year out of 100. So I won't even say rare. It's just uncommon. It costs them a lot energy-wise. So that's why we don't see that. We don't see endless attempts. Now, I have hens that very consistently will try to nest two or three times before they give up for the year.
Hmm. And with each of those subsequent re-nesting attempts, you know, when I think about pheasants and quail, the number of eggs in a clutch precipitously drops. You know, say it's average of 11, second nest attempt, maybe there's a 7, third nest attempt, maybe 3. Is that also accurate with turkeys?
Yep, spot on.
Okay. Thinking about, so we've talked about nesting, brood ring habitat. What about winter habitat between the two birds? Sarah, what do turkeys need? And I recognize when I say winter, talking from Minnesota, is dramatically different than where you grew up in Florida. So tell us about that a little bit. What do turkeys need outside of nesting and brood rearing season across their range?
Right. So as we move from fall and winter in turkeys, we go from a relatively solitary period during the reproductive season. We start to see those hens amalgamate their broods, so bring those young poults together, and then we start to see formation of flocks. Those flocks are forming in the fall, and we see a large increase typically in home range sizes. So that's where we're jumping from that 500 to 750 acre home range up to almost 2,000 acres in some cases. Mm. Now, that's a function of habitat quality and landscape composition. Those are just kind of rough averages for the southeast. But turkeys can do that because they're following these mast resources, right? This is where turkeys especially become a forest bird. They're following your oak and hickories that are producing mast crop in the fall and winter.
Okay, so when that leads to probably a pretty obvious distinction where turkeys need acorns or some sort of nut for their food source or some hardy seed that quail maybe need something a bit smaller. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely.
So as you think about landowners, and I'll throw this one to Jackson, that want a landowner that wants to have both, it, like gold medal award-winning habitat for turkeys and the same thing for quail. Can a landowner have that on their property, or is there a distinction that, well, if you want that for quail as well, then you are going to need something a little bit different, which is the woodlot, which isn't as beneficial to quail? Because what I'm thinking about is the last time you were on, we were talking about basal rate and sunshine getting through to the forest floor. Like, to me, there seems like there's a distinction between the two types of habitat, but maybe I'm wrong. Help me understand the difference, Jackson.
Yeah, there certainly is. And it depends on where you are in the country. I mean, when I was in Missouri, those birds are using, well, they're just in a different habitat than the birds in, say, Louisiana. So if you're a landowner and you want to manage for both quail and wild turkey, your management plan is going to look different if you're in Southeast Nebraska versus, central Louisiana. But the main takeaway for quail, going back to Dr. Martin's quail quadrilateral, it's pretty solid across the quail range what their needs are. They need, like you said, Bob, they are a grassland shrub obligate. Jeez. So that is going to hold true for Bob Whites throughout their range. What we can do in the Southeast for a landowner who wants to manage for both turkeys and quail, as a turkey hunter, a hardwood river bottom is like, that's great. Right, Ryan? I mean, that's what you're looking for in like roosting habitat, midday loafing habitat. When it's hot out, it's cool down there, it's shaded. So those hardwood bottoms, we're not really going to be able to turn that into quail habitat. They're wet. Those hardwood trees, like your water oaks, they don't like prescribed fire. That's a bottomland system. So that's going to be your turkey habitat. Now we can go in there and say, okay, here's some Chinese tallow that's invasive. That's going to crowd this out and degrade the habitat quality for turkey. So we need to get rid of those. Other invasives that we'd be looking for to try and keep it a healthy hardwood bottom for turkeys. And then we shift to the uplands on that person's property and say, okay, this is a dog hair thicket of pine trees, and we need to bring the basal area down and recreate or restore that upland system, which is native grasses, wildflowers, few trees, letting that sunlight hit the ground to stimulate that herbaceous vegetation that quail require.
And then that becomes great quality brood habitat for both species.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I'm starting to pick it up. let's talk a little bit about mythology. There is a perspective that turkeys push out quail in a given area, and based on what we just talked about, it seems to me that they're not pushing them out. We're just talking about two different ideal types of habitat that benefits birds based on their needs. Talk about that a little bit, Sarah. Have you witnessed turkeys pushing quail out of habitat?
Not just push them out, they eat them.
Well, we were going to get to that. Yeah.
One at a time. Yeah, so whenever I have someone approach me, I work with a lot of private landowners to do my research, and they'll say something along those lines. They're like, well, I used to have both. I had turkeys and quail, and then the turkeys started doing well, and that pushed my quail out. And their observation is correct. They have noticed quail decline and turkey numbers increase. However, it's not – the quail getting pushed out is not because of the turkeys. What they're observing is actually vegetation succession. Nothing's been done to the habitat. Nothing's been done to the landscape there. So what was once quail habitat is either become low quality quail habitat, so their numbers are declining, or it is no longer habitat for quail. Turkeys have more plasticity. They can tolerate a bit more. So when these early successional communities start to become a little bit more rank, gets a little thicker, a little bit more dense, turkeys will still tolerate that for nesting habitat. So yes, you're still going to have turkeys there, but for a quail, you can't move around in something like that. So typically when we see that, when I have someone tell me that, they're talking about vegetation succession and not an actual pushing out, not an actual direct competition between quail and turkey.
So it does go back to that basal rate in bare ground for quail to move around. And I think about prescribed fire. We can't have a conversation about bobwhite quail habitat without talking about prescribed fire, especially in the Southeast, like every 2 years to maintain kind of that early successional habitat. You talked about the plasticity or the adaptability of turkeys. How much do they benefit from prescribed fire? It sounds like they don't need it quite as frequently, Sarah, as quail, but I'm assuming that they benefit from habitat management too.
They can benefit from the same fire rate that quail do. They're just willing to tolerate when we don't get out there as frequently, right? Whereas, a quail might be more rigid. They have specific needs that need to happen on this very specific timetable based on the conditions, whereas a turkey is going to have a little bit more forgiveness because they, like I said, they have kind of more adaptability. They can use more areas than a quail can.
All right, Ryan asked a moment ago, Sarah, about, we hear this particularly on our social channels, the turkeys are eating all the bobwhites. Is that true, Sarah?
No. No, it is not. I watched one choke on an acorn one time. Now, that's not to say it doesn't happen or it never happens, but turkeys, no, they are not eating bobwhite quail. I think Jackson actually had done a bit of research and found the source, I think, of a lot of that. Of that myth.
Do tell.
Yeah, no kidding. Where's the source, Jackson?
So it was a monograph written in 1931 by Herbert Stoddard, and he observed, and the paper wasn't even about turkey or quail. What was it about, Sarah? I forget.
It was about quail. He was making actually like dietary observations of quail.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So there was a free-ranging domestic turkey that he allegedly, I'm going to say allegedly because there was no picture, but he observed this free-ranging domestic turkey destroy and eat a quail nest. It's never shown up in the literature other than that one instance in the 30s. And when you have two species that have been extensively researched for a century, if it was a common behavior for wild turkeys to be depredating on quail, it would show up, but it doesn't because it's not happening to the extent that people think that it is. I mean, if that was a significant factor in quail declines, we would be seeing it in the literature. I'm not gonna bet $1,000 that it doesn't happen. I've seen deer eat fish and songbirds. I mean, they're wild animals. They're gonna be opportunistic. But I wouldn't bet a dollar that it is having any kind of significant impact on quail.
All right, I've got to ask about the deer eating the fish.
A trout washed up on the stream bank, and this doe, it was in the spring, so does are having a hard time that time of year, right? They're growing little baby fawns and going through some nutrient deficiencies, and come across this dead trout and just went at it. We've had them when I was miss netting songbirds in college. We would go check our songbird traps in the spring and just find this mushy mess from, you know, a deer walking by, and is like, there's some protein. I'm gonna get after it. So.
Well, it goes to your point that we're talking about wild animals, you know, and who amongst us hasn't opened up a crop of a pheasant or a rough grouse, for instance, and found a frog or a snake. They, like you say, they're opportunivores. They'll eat whatever looks good at the moment. So it goes without saying it has likely happened that a turkey has eaten a quail chick, but they're not a top tier predator of bobwhite.
Yeah, I wouldn't guarantee that it's happened. I'd say it's plausible. Mm. Mm. I wouldn't say that it's common.
Hmm. All right, as we round third and head towards home on this intersection between turkey and quail, Sparks, I want to get to your final thoughts and go around the horn. Anything that we haven't asked these two that you'd like to bring up, or any final thoughts from a turkey nut like yourself?
Well, I would say this from personal experience. We started doing habitat work on our family farm, specifically for quail, 12 to 15 years ago, I would say. When we started, every year we had about one covey of quail that we knew that hung out on the property. And we had turkeys and deer that would be on the property between spring through the summer and then into the fall. And then they would leave and they would go down towards the river to find better habitat for the winter. And through the process of doing removing eastern red cedar, planting native grasses and forbs for nesting habitat, doing prescribed fire, all sorts of stuff. Now we have from year to year anywhere from 4 to 5 coveys on the same property, and we have deer and turkeys throughout the whole year, which is really cool to see those big flocks, like Sarah was talking about, working their way across the field, getting in the grasses. You can hear them jumping up in the trees and roost in the evening. So we were not trying to manage for deer or turkeys. We were specifically trying to improve things for quail. And, they're that umbrella species. They kind of raise all the other ships. So,
yeah, that underscores my exact same takeaway. You know, both Jackson and Sarah have talked about, like, if you do great things for quail, that's the harder species to sort of influence, and turkeys sort of come along for the ride when you do things that are beneficial for quail. Turkeys are going to benefit probably multifold because they are they have more plasticity, as I learned from Sarah. Sarah, we're going to give you, ladies, get the final thought. Jackson, what's your closing thought for this conversation?
I think Ryan did a pretty good job at stealing my final thought. that's good. But yeah, quality quail habitat is quality wildlife habitat. Everything's going to use it. But also I want to give a shout out to our partners and landowners here in Louisiana. I was talking about the success that we've had in a short 2 years, and that's only possible through those partnerships and landowners coming and asking us to trusting us to come out onto their property and work with them to develop management plans. And if you're listening, looking for somebody to come out to your property, like I said, I've got 7 biologists in the state, soon to be 8, hopefully. Hopefully very soon, but you can get online, go to quailforever.org at the bottom of our home screen. You'll click a tab that says find a biologist, and then you'll enter your zip code and click search, and all of our contact information will pop up. And same with the chapters too. If you want to get involved with the chapter, there's a function on our website that works the same way.
Yeah, right on that. And that goes for anywhere in the country, whether your focus is in, improving quail habitat and benefiting turkeys in Tennessee to Florida to Nebraska. We can help you out. Just go on quailforever.org and find a biologist tab. All right, Sarah, final words, and they're all yours.
Ah, thanks. I think if we take anything away from what we've talked about today is that quail and turkey are both birds that rely heavily on disturbance. If you go out there and do something, you're going to make an improvement, whether that's fire, a disc, a roller chopper, thinning stands, etc. These are birds that like disturbance. And if you can go out there and manage for, like we've said, quality quail habitat, turkeys are going to benefit quite a bit too. You might not maximize both, but you're going to do better for both. And that's really the kind of like my takeaway that I always tell people. Sitting around and thinking about what you could do isn't going to actually get you what you want. Just go out and try something. Go out and ruffle some feathers. Go out and burn something.
Wise words. Go out and ruffle some feathers. Go out and burn something. How much longer do you have left of your studies, Sarah?
So we've wrapped up 3 years of very intensive field work. We are starting or in the midst of kind of a fourth. We've expanded our project to Eastern Kentucky. But as far as my dissertation goes, I have all the data I need to write. Now I just need to quit thinking about chasing birds this spring and actually sit down in the office and write it.
Get out there and ruffle some feathers. Finish that.
Yeah, working on it.
Well, thank you for spending time with us. Good luck as you finish off your studies. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. For Quail Forever Journal editor Ryan Sparks, for Sarah Watkins and Jackson Shaken, Not Stirred Martini, I'm Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.